Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today we bring you Christina Antello. Christina is a senior Democratic strategist, and she is a principal, founder, CEO of Varak Strategies, which we're going to hear all about. We're also going to hear about how she may be the only person in government relations who has worked at Goldman Sachs and now founded her own lobbying firm. We are very excited to have her on the show. She came to us via Nicole, who was on the show last week. Christina, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I love this invitation.
Well, we're glad to have you. So you're at Goldman Sachs and you decide to leave and go to law school.
I do. Absolutely. I went to Georgetown and I had majored in government. I thought I was going to be in government. I worked and did my internships on Capitol Hill, like most of us do, I think, around town. And I was literally bored out of my mind. And I was like, is this really what I thought I was signing up for? And I had done an internship on Wall Street. And when Goldman called me up and offered me the job, I was like, absolutely, that was fun. That was exciting. But it was back in the time when Elian Gonzalez was the story of the day. And I'm of Cuban background. And I remember being kind of torn back into it and said to myself, like, I am not supposed to be looking up the price of Target for this billionaire Bobby on the phone. And I should be thinking about that kind of policy stuff. And I need to get back there.
When you said you were bored doing what?
I was answering the phones. It was back when there was a DC subcommittee that doesn't exist any longer, but I was answering the phones. I was doing crossword puzzles and circulating mail. That's what interns normally do. And I get that. There's some earning of stripes that's required, but I was so bored. And instead, the internship on Wall Street was pricing a derivatives books with Canadian swaps, and we were looking to take on a multi-million dollar deal. And I thought that was a lot sexier than doing all that mail circulation there on Capitol Hill.
But after 4 years at Goldman, you decided that you were kind of done doing that and wanted to get back to the government, which is where your interest began.
Listen, I loved working for Goldman Sachs. I had never, ever taken a finance course at any point in my life. And all of a sudden, I was in the middle of, again, some big deals and learning all about the way the economy works, the way that money works, the way that businesses think about things and business people think about things. It was an amazing education and I love every piece of it still, but I love policy. I love talking about policy and I love being a part of policy.
So let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in Texas?
Dallas, Texas. Yep.
Dallas, Texas. Okay. Any siblings?
Nope. I'm the spoiled rotten only one, which my husband will confirm for you at any given point.
And what did your parents do?
So my parents immigrated to the United States in 59 and 61. So they actually kind of, they have the traditional immigration story that my dad actually worked his way through. He put himself through college. That was in the Vietnam era. He was drafted and actually served in Germany during the Vietnam era. My mom, his sweetheart that he left behind, was here working kind of an administrative job. And I actually remember being a little kid many, many years later when she decided to go to night school and get her associate's degree. And they both actually ended up working for the city of Dallas in different capacities. And my dad was the originator, the computer programmer that brought the 911 program to the city of Dallas back in the 1980s.
And was your dad, when they came here, was that part of the Peter Pan program? Is that what it was called?
My dad was actually a Peter Pan kid. My mom had a different story, but yeah, my dad was 15, didn't speak English very well. And he had four siblings and he was responsible for bringing my aunt, who was two, and my uncle, who was five at the time. And so 15 years old, he gets on a plane with no belongings allowed to be brought with him. And he brings over a two-year-old, a toddler, and a five-year-old to a new country with no possessions again and doesn't speak the language. And he was responsible for about 6 months before my grandparents were able to meet him here to take care of the three of them.
Incredible. And so his parents put him on a plane. And I would imagine he had a family he was going to stay with that his parents didn't even know. And they put him on a plane thinking they may never see any of them ever again.
I think, you know, they obviously had a plan and they were hopeful that that wouldn't be the case. So it certainly always is the risk. And
right.
It did take some time. But, you know, the other two brothers had to come across separately and they stayed in different families. And so it did take some time for all five siblings to get reunited together with their parents. But that ultimately did happen. There was another program in the United States where Catholic churches were taking these families in and kind of sponsoring them with if they settled in different communities. And that's why we ended up in Dallas, because a Catholic church in Dallas sponsored my dad's family.
That's incredible. What a great story. So you end up at Georgetown and you study government. You go to Goldman Sachs for 4 years And then you go to law school at GW?
Uh-huh. Yep. Right here in town.
And did you have any internships on the Hill when you were at GW? Or maybe you were interning at law firms?
I did do a stint at DLA Piper, but I had also worked on the Senate side for then Senators Clinton and Daschle for the steering committee, the Democratic steering committee, and did some voter outreach and some constituent kind of outreach that they do kind of through the policy committee.
Okay. Do you know Jim Halpert at DLA Piper?
He runs I do.
Yeah. Jim runs the Privacy Coalition, and he has these very large calls with people on them. Yeah.
I was at DLA Piper in kind of like the prime time of the office. And so he constantly got teased for being Jim Halpert.
Yeah. Well, and why don't you tell our listeners his connection to the office? It's not just a coincidence.
No. I think he's like friends with one of the writers or something like that. I didn't remember. But he's definitely got the connection. And I think he's, if not the inspiration for, definitely connected to.
Yeah. So I think the showrunner was his college roommate or friend growing up. And made the character after him. So what did you do at DLA Piper?
At DLA, I was actually part of the lobbying team. And, you know, I think lobbying at a law firm is a little different than lobbying at a boutique shop. But the team there that I worked with had been lobbying for quite some time, and they definitely knew the ins and outs. And they did approach lobbying kind of from that law firm perspective, where things are very meticulously researched and cases are made based off of court cases and things like that. I mean, the reason you hire a lawyer to be your lobbyist is because you have a legal case to make. And so there is a lot more work and preparation, I think, that goes into it that is certainly different than just advocating for an earmark or something like that, for example. And so I really learned to be very meticulous in the kind of development of my advocacy of arguments and things like that there. But in 2008, when the economy kind of dropped out, you know, it ended up being law firms in particular in Washington were hard hit. And I think I was performing well and I was doing okay. I don't think in jeopardy of losing my job there, but I kind of then it just crystallized for me in one moment that I was like, wait, I actually really like this lobbying stuff and this lawyering stuff is kind of for the birds. Like, I'd rather be up on Capitol Hill a lot more instead of like with my nose in a law book. So I made the move over to a boutique firm in town, one of the best ones that was around at that time. And decided I just really wanted to focus on being one of the varsity team players and out there on Capitol Hill really making the case for our clients.
And how long did you spend there?
Almost a decade.
Oh, wow.
Yep, until they closed their doors. And I kind of decided like, well, you know what? I've now kind of honed and really perfected this practice here. I think I can give it a shot on my own. So let me at least try it. And you know, you're not really kind of given those opportunities in life too many times where you can really just set out on your own. And I was like, if it doesn't work out, it's fine. There's plenty of other firms, I think, that I could probably have conversations with, but I want to give it a shot.
And you started the firm with you have a partner, correct?
So yeah, I started the firm in the fall of 2017, or maybe February of 2018, with someone that came with me from the Podesta Group, Lucy Alonso, and she's our chief of staff. And then we started on day one, we had two clients. Day two, we had three clients. We probably built up to about 8 to 10 clients over the course of that first year. But one of the things that I had missed from the Podesta Group was the bipartisan kind of ability of the firm to be able to talk to both sides of the aisle and the administration, quite frankly. And, you know, as a Democrat, I didn't have a lot of access at that time to the Trump administration. You know, I could kind of bank into a couple of offices here and there, but not a steady stream of information coming from there. So I really thought it was important that Ferox be bipartisan. And so when I came across Mark Williams, who was chief of staff for Mike Conaway from Texas, also kind of a Dallas guy like me, so we had a lot in common. He had two little kids, like I have two little kids, and we kind of really just clicked. And so it's not even like I had this, you know, decade-long relationship with him and decided, hey, let's figure this out together. I met him and we meshed instantly. I wanted to have a Republican on board and he came on board to lead the Republican efforts. And he's been delivering ever since on both the House and the Senate side, as well as the Trump administration, which has really been amazing.
And now I think the bipartisan nature is really important, because then you don't have to kind of adjust. You know, if you can believe the polls right now, there are some changes coming and you may be taking the lead in a lot of areas that over the past 2 to 4 years, he was taking the lead. So I think that's pretty wise.
No, absolutely. But you know what I did learn, there was a point in time where Democrats ran this town for a couple of years then too. And you know, it was amazing to learn the lesson that Republicans were more valuable at that point in time in some instances, because sometimes to slow things down or to blow them up, you just need to have somebody on the other side of the aisle throw a grenade for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, any one of those members, you know, 100 on the Senate side and 435 on the House side can write a letter calling for an investigation. And if 20 senators or 20 members of Congress write a letter asking for an investigation, sometimes that can be enough. And so you don't necessarily always have to run things through the majority. And a lot of times to get attention on your issue, if you're not necessarily just looking to pass legislation, but you're trying to educate folks on your issue or try to get movement on something that's not working correctly, you can accomplish that within the minority as well. And I think people overlook that and kind of become too focused on their own, kind of with their blinders on, their own party, their own folks, the same folks they go to over and over again. And you don't start to think creatively, well, like, hey, wait a second, we can accomplish the same ends through a different means and get even more attention maybe.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point, Christina. You having support on both sides of the aisle for whatever issue you may be working on is critically important. Because as you say, it doesn't take much to stop something or slow it down or cause a problem. And so you did not spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill. How do you develop relationships now?
Yeah, you know, I always find that interesting because for a lot of folks, they say, you know, in order to be a lobbyist, you have to be kind of, it's almost a requirement to work on Capitol Hill for X number of years. And I think, you know, I'm a proponent of that. You certainly learn a lot there. It's not just the network, but you kind of learn the substance of matters, but you also learn the procedure. And so if you kind of skip that step, it is possible to still be successful as a lobbyist, but you have to commit yourself to still learning those three kind of sides of the stool, as I call it, kind of. You have to have a network, you have to have the substance, and you have to have the procedure. You have to know those things. And so if you're not going to be up there to learn it organically, then you have to commit yourself to the study of those things and to developing that network. And I remember I was at DLA when I kind of made that decision and understood and appreciated kind of that I would need those three things. And I was, you know, a young attorney, I was an associate, and I was, you know, responsible for billing my 2000 hours a year. And I would, you know, come to work every day at 8 and I would, you know, put in all my hours. And at about 5 or 6 o'clock, I would leave, I would go to Capitol Hill and go to whatever reception I could get myself invited to, whatever event was going on that I had some kind of way to get into, I would go up there and I would do my networking from 5 to 7 or 6 to 8. And then I would go back to the law firm at 7 or 8 o'clock at night and get back to work and finish kind of the work that I needed to do by the day. And whenever The Daily Show with Jon Stewart back then would come on TV at 11, I knew that it was time to go home. So then I would commute back home at 11 and kind of, you know, watch that kind of on rewind because I would program it. And then go to bed at midnight and then be back at the law firm the next day at 8 a.m. But I knew that those 2 hours every night, while not billable to clients, and some people might be like, oh, well, that's not for work, that's my personal time. I knew that it was important for my professional development. And I was committed to that for, you know, at least 3 to 4 nights a week. I would be out there every night just doing the networking piece of it.
Well, I think that's a great, I mean, first of all, your work ethic for everyone out there wanting to get into lobbying, she went back to the office to 11 o'clock at night. I mean, that's just incredible. Now, those large law firms are tough places to work and people, you know, put in a lot of hours, and I'm sure you were doing well. But I love how you talked about the network and the procedure and understanding the different aspects of the job and taking them all very seriously. Because if you have the network, but you don't understand the policy and the process for getting it done, you're not really going to be that helpful. You have to understand all three.
I think that's the thing. You have to understand all three, and you have to have, you know, a strength in at least one of them, and usually two of them will make you successful. But you have to have an appreciation for all three. And I remember, like, there was, you know, now he's an amazing Senate candidate, Jamie Harrison, but he used to run the whip operation on Capitol Hill. There was nobody coming off of Capitol Hill that had a better network in the Democratic Party than Jamie Harrison back in those days. And so, you know, he was able to kind of think about it in terms of his network. You know, and then there are some folks who really specialize in a particular sector, right? So a healthcare lobbyist who knows 340B inside and out. I would shoot myself in the head if I had to know that. I'm not interested in that. But there are some folks who really can make a profession of knowing the intricacies about every single piece of healthcare lobbying. And then there are other folks who just, you know, really start to know procedure really well. And you figure that out on the appropriate side, right? Like, appropriation is its own beast. And there's not a lot of people in this town that really get into the nitty gritty of understanding appropriates inside and out. So you can really make a specialty out of any one of the three, but most people don't kind of do that. So you at least have to have you know, some kind of, you know, a combination of the three to be able to succeed here, I think. And so I, you know, I run as a generalist, so I know enough to be dangerous on a lot of topics. I know enough about procedure and know that I don't know appropriations well. So our chief of staff is an expert on that. So I, you know, make sure that we cover our six on that one, if you will. And then network is like, it's constantly changing. There's, you know, the average or median age of a congressional staffer is 27. I am well above 27. And so that I have to make sure that I'm constantly out there and meeting the new 27-year-olds that like land on Capitol Hill every year. And you got to keep that network up.
So we had a John Raffaele at Capitol Council. We had him on, and he put it in terms of the four P's, if I can remember them: people, politics, procedure, and maybe policy, and personality. And he talked about when he's hiring people or working with people, those are the skills that you want as a good lobbyist. And if you have all those, you're really well positioned to do well. But if you have, you know, he said in the old days, you probably could just be a people personality and get away with it. But today you really can't. You have to understand the policy, understand the process of Capitol Hill, the procedure, and obviously know the people as to who's doing what and who's kind of pulling the levers. So
I think that's right. I think lobbying in this town has changed a little bit over the last decade or so. I think you're right. There were a lot of people who were just like, hey, I'm a former member and I know everybody and I can get in the door and shake hands and introduce you. But they themselves weren't able or not interested in making the argument themselves or doing the advocacy themselves. They were more than happy to open the door, but not to be a staunch advocate. And I don't think you can do that anymore. I think that, you know, there are limited stories of that kind of success anymore. And I think now you have to be a zealous advocate. People are like, if I'm paying you this amount of money, I want you to get out there and make the case for me. I want you to be my advocate, the face of my brand or my issue, my problem. And really be a zealous advocate. And I think I'm hearing more and more kind of feedback from folks that is what they're looking for. And they're not as interested anymore in kind of the lazy lobbyist who just turns in kind of the clips from Politico or whatever it might be.
Right. And it's harder because you have to take the time up front to learn the issue, you know, to kind of use your training from DLA Piper to kind of dive in, understand the company, understand the issue, understand the nuances, understand the history. And it takes time. And it's much easier just to be kind of the backslapper.
That's absolutely right. You know, we have a policy analyst on board, and the first job she has to learn is to learn how to do the backgrounder, right? Whenever there's a prospect that we're going to talk to, I don't want to just go into a room and not know anything about what they're going to ask me to do. Like, I want to know already so that I'm prepared, so that I already have some answers kind of ready to go. So they present to me what they think is a new problem, and then I've already got, well, here off the top of my head, here are five potential things that I would go do to start thinking about that. Or like, these are the committees of jurisdiction that I know handle your problem. And these are the six members on that committee that I'm really close with. And here's how I would go talk to them about that. Like, I want to be prepared for that in that moment. I don't want to miss that opportunity to make a good first impression. You know, so it's like really having that ability to be smart. I think that's also another thing I learned at Goldman, for example, right? So like, not just even what that policy issue is, but now think about it like the way the business person thinks about it. The first thing I do every time I get a new client is, if they are a public company, I put that ticker into like my stock watch on my iPhone, and I watch their stocks, and I see that it goes up and it goes down, and they're impacted by whatever policy happens. And I will know on any given day, today is not the day for us to go to the CEO and give him more bad news because his stock just dropped 3 points and here are the reasons why, and he's probably dealing with that. And knowing that, or seeing kind of those stories, the business stories, and then anticipate and be able to offer maybe the political solution of like, hey, we should go talk to Congressman so-and-so about that issue we just saw in the paper because maybe they'll help be your advocate on this or that or whatever it might be. So offering them a potential political solution to a business problem that they're not thinking about because they don't care about Washington when they're running their businesses wherever they are.
Yeah. So you prepare like that for a potential prospect?
Every single one of them.
Wow.
We waste a lot of hours with business that doesn't come in sometimes. And that is the risk. We do it anyway. And because I don't like not knowing the answer or not having at least the basis of an answer. Like, I'm not one of those people that's happy to just be like, I have no idea and I can't offer you anything. Like, I want to at least come to any conversation with some type of smart and savvy conversation that I can entertain with them and potentially offer them solution.
Well, there's that work ethic again, that 7 to 11 p.m. coming into play. Wow. Yeah, that takes a lot of time and effort. If you don't mind me asking, how many clients do you guys in general have today? I know you said you had two when you started.
Yeah, no, I think we have 14 now. Some of them aren't LDA, so they're not all public, but I think we have about 14.
And tell us about the different aspects of your firm. You obviously do federal lobbying. Do you focus on a certain area? Do you do coalition building? Do you do state government relations? Tell us about all the things you do.
So it's funny, I have run state coalitions, and we can do that on the state GR side. We're not doing that currently right now. We do a lot of public affairs work, a lot of groups in town and kind of developing coalitions and the ability to kind of find ways to advocate that's not just the client saying it, but have somebody else be like, hey, this client is awesome. Because it's always better to hear those affirmations from somebody else and not you telling everybody that you're awesome. So we do a lot of that as well. Obviously, the federal GR space, we're bipartisan. So we work both sides of the aisle, you know, both houses of Congress. We work the administration, all the agencies for a whole bunch of our clients. Our clients, I mean, we are generalist here. We run the gamut. We don't have a specialty. I mean, we have, you know, some big retail shops. We have a generic pharmaceutical. We do some economic development for a BRACT base down in Texas. We have Walmart, right? The largest employer in the United States. And we really run the gamut. We do some stuff in Homeland Security, really have focused on that over the last couple of years and made that a niche. And we've really kind of had like our fingers dabbling in a lot of big policy issues, like, you know, from surprise medical billing back in the day, we were helping the self-insurers. And we really kind of just run the gamut and do as much of it as we can kind of from different perspectives.
And pre-COVID, how often would you find yourself running up to Capitol Hill? I mean, I know you said at DLA Piper almost every night for a reception. Was that still the case now when you're on your own? Even more so, probably.
Yeah, my office is literally a 7-minute walk from Cannon and about a 6-minute walk to Russell. So we purposely picked this location and we were up there all the time doing meetings for clients, doing the receptions, kind of doing the fundraisers. And we had a very visible presence on Capitol Hill regularly.
And it's a tough business. It's competitive. There's a lot of companies have a lot of options.
They do. They do. Absolutely.
Does it get tiring bumping into competitors in the hallways?
No, I don't think about it that way. I have a lot of friends at competing firms and I enjoy their company. And I think a lot of us have a mutual respect for each other. You know, again, I think some of it is kind of maybe generational and what have you. I think a lot of us were kind of on that backbench JV team at the same times. And now that we're elevated to be the varsity teams that we've seen each other grow up and do that. I've seen a lot of my friends grow into like the heads of office in a lot of different shops here in town. And that is really amazing and cool to watch. So I more promote that. And in this town, I mean, you can't think of it on the short term. Anybody that's got a short term time horizon doesn't get the game. Like they don't, like if you're not here to be here for 40 years, like, I mean, this is the only town where you can carry somebody's luggage one day. And then at the next campaign, you're their chief of staff. Like, how does that happen? That doesn't happen in any other industry, but here in DC, it is regular. So it is better to keep your personal relationships intact, regardless of what's going on the professional side, because 2 years from now, it's all going to be different. And 10 years from now, that person's going to be running something and it's better to have them think nicely of you than not.
It's so true. So true. True also in state capitals across country. One day an intern, you know, next day, not next day, but down the road, chief of staff. Yeah. Every chief of staff started as an intern at one point.
That's right.
Yeah. And do you guys offer internships in your office?
We do. We actually had one this summer with the Congressional Hispanic Leadership Institute. Daniel was a legal fellow with us over the summer. And now I think we have a new one starting next week, actually, also from Chile. So we have a great partnership with them. And we get some amazing, amazing candidates. I also love having the opportunity available to diverse students who might not otherwise get an opportunity to work in Washington. And so I love being able to offer that and give them the exposure here that, you know, I want to diversify and have Washington look as much like America as possible. And, you know, you don't get to do that if you're not the type of background that allows you to come live in a city that's as expensive as Washington for free for 6 months and kind of just donate your time. And so I'm happy to be a part of an organization that kind of creates those opportunities for folks that might not otherwise be able to do it.
And you also had a fellowship at one point.
I did. So the reason I ended up at Georgetown, I will say, is I'm with an organization called A Better Chance. And A Better Chance actually found me when I was back in Dallas, and I think junior high, maybe even younger than that. But I took a state kind of recognition course with them. I took the SAT when I was in seventh grade, I think, and got state recognition. A Better Chance found me. They gave me this application and they submitted it to a bunch of prep schools all along the Northeast. And I actually got myself a scholarship to go to a boarding school in New England at the age of 15. And the thinking there is if you get a better secondary education, you'll get a better college education, you'll get a better job, you'll get a better chance. And so they think that by the time you go to college, it may already be too late, that, you know, some of the things are already baked. And so they really kind of focus on that better secondary school education. And thank goodness they did, because I can't imagine the trajectory of my life without it if I hadn't been opened up to politics in Georgetown and not seeing outside of Cedar Hill, Texas, right outside of Dallas at such a young age.
And are you still involved in the Congressional Hispanic Caucus?
I am. I'm the Institute. So the Institute is their C3 arm, and we raise money for internships on Capitol Hill. I'm still on the board. I've been on the board for about 6 years. So I think this is my final term, so I'll be rolling off. But that has really been an amazing experience working with CHCI. You know, I've watched the Hispanic Caucus grow in its membership, and really, you know, we weathered some hard financial times, but we have come out the other end of that now, even more financially solvent than before. And we are weathering this pandemic in a way that has been amazing. And our kids, our students are so resilient. Like, they are still so very anxious and willing to participate in the policy process in whatever way that we can make available to them. And that has been so, so very cool to watch.
Well, Christina, it has been great to have you on the show. Great to hear about your career and your firm and all the work that you're doing. Let me ask you one last question. How are we doing currently in regards to diversity in government relations? Are we doing better, the same, worse?
In government relations, so specifically on K Street, you know,
yes.
I think that there's been improvement. I think the same way that we've seen some improvement with members and slowly, more slowly, I think, with congressional staff. But I think there's been some improvement. There are certainly more folks that are kind of coming up and coming up that ladder. I do still kind of see a challenge in that, you know, there's a lot of firms who still maybe don't get it, that they think that they're checking a box by having somebody of color when they don't see the value. And there is actual strategic business value in it. And that is, you know, one of the lessons I learned at the Podesta Group. You know, like, there are 58 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, 37 members of the Hispanic Caucus, 20 members of the Asian Caucus, 120 women on Capitol Hill. And I was like, you can't take the same, you know, old white guy to go talk to all of those audiences with the same advocacy and efficacy. And so I think that they, you know, having people that look like those members actually gives you a better result. Not only that, but it's not just seeing the faces, that they understand the importance of the various issues to those members. They have a better ability to relate and to advocate for things in ways that are more authentic. And so, you know, when you can put together, I mean, it's half of the Democratic caucus. The Tri-Caucus makes up half of the Democratic caucus. So if you are trying to move Nancy Pelosi to do something and you get 100 of her members from the CBC, CHC, and the Asian caucus to come and say, we care about this, she's got to listen to that. I mean, there is a reason why she has created, you know, positions in leadership to make sure that the leadership positions are reflective of African-Americans and Latinos and women, even LGBTQ. She knows that those constituencies matter, and you have to be able to bring them along with whatever your policy goals are. And I think that that's increasing in the Senate as well, slowly, more slowly, but surely. And, you know, there is a business proposition to be had there, because a lot of times companies want to be able to say, like, oh, I want to convince people of this. How do I do it? And it's like, if you can figure out ways to make those arguments to various constituencies, you think about it maybe sometimes in terms of ideological caucuses, like, oh, we're going to talk to the New Dems, or we're going to talk to, you know, the steering committee or whatever it might be. But if you can also find ways to bring along these other groups, like, let's convince women of this, because women would care a lot about childcare or education or whatever the issue might be, or safe sidewalks, all these other things, then you bring them on as a constituency, and all of a sudden you can have, you know, again, a great number of folks coming on board through kind of one policy argument. And I think that there, again, is great business value there. And it's not just about checking a box so that your website has one face of color. It's more that they bring more to the table and can really enhance your strategies.
Good point, Christina, and well said. Again, Christina, thank you for coming on. And to our listeners, remember, you can follow us on social media, on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. You can sign up for our Monday morning email at thepoliticallife.net. Comes out, you guessed it, every Monday morning. Well, if we're a little slow, it may be Monday afternoon, but it will come out. And it'll come out along with the show, and you'll get little tidbits about the show kind of behind the scenes. So sign up for that if you want to. And we hope you all have a great week. We're getting close to the election. It will be over soon. Stay safe, and we'll see you all next Monday.